We apologize to council and to our spectators as to the conditions this morning. We had a bit of a heating malfunction, and I just want to assure council for both sides, this is not a test of your endurance. If at any point the chill's getting to you and you need a recess, just let us know. Same with my colleagues. And with that note, we'll call United States against Schroeder, counsel for the defense.
Good morning, Your Honors. May I please support Mary Hall and Major John Page for the appellant, Chief Master Sergeant Paul Schroeder. First question, I'd like to reserve 5 minutes of my time.
That's granted. Thank you.
Thank you. I'd like to turn first to issue two, which is whether or not it was plain error for the trial counsel to argue on the merits that the members needed to render justice to the victim of uncharged misconduct, and whether the trial counsel also engaged in plain error by arguing that the members should punish the appellant for having engaged in uncharged misconduct with the same victim. Turning first to that issue, I would note that in reviewing this issue, one really needs to pay very close attention to the appellate exhibit, which contains the photographs of the three girls, one of the girls who is portrayed as the 9-year-old. She was the subject of the uncharged misconduct. Then there is a young teenage vintage photo of who is the appellant's natural daughter. And then there is a picture of 13-year-old who is unrelated to the appellant, but who forms the basis of the indecent acts charge, which is the original charge. So if not this charge, we're committing indecent acts in 2001. He was also charged with having raped his natural daughter in 1987. But even before 1987 were these uncharged misconduct acts involving the stepdaughter. And again, this photograph shows all three of the girls, including the 9-year-old. He had no charges on the charge sheet involving her, again, strictly uncharged misconduct. The trial counsel on the merits, though, Your Honors, said that this case details events lasting 20 years. Three different girls, one common ground, that this man who sits in the courtroom raped, molested, and committed indecent acts with each of them. He tried to convey to the members that they had some type of obligation to render justice. They, of course, had no such obligation. Their obligation was to listen to the instructions of the military judge and to apply the facts to the law as the military judge so instructed them. They had no moral obligation to a purported victim of uncharged misconduct whatsoever. At the end of the argument on the merits, again, with this photograph being part of a slideshow, the trial counsel argued, don't forget about the victims. Don't forget about and they appear on that picture. The pictures are silent, but their silence screams for justice. So there was no clarification from the trial counsel here that he was urging justice solely for the two purported victims on the charge sheet. Well, with sentencing, the same theme continued, and the same photograph was presented as part of a slideshow. So again, imagine, if you will, Your Honors, the trial counsel not just uttering the words that are contained in the record of trial, but this photograph, some type of electronic billboard, if you will, advertising to the members, sending this message that there are really three girls in issue here rather than two. On sentencing, the trial counsel said, look at those girls. That is why we are here today. They deserve justice. They have been waiting for years for justice. They scream for justice. Members, make sure your sentence delivers justice to those girls. Again, a reference to the three girls, including 9-year-old photograph. Now, Your Honors, it is okay, it's certainly permissible for a trial counsel to urge the panel members to consider uncharged misconduct in their deliberations on sentencing, but our position is that the trial counsel impermissibly crossed that line by urging the members to punish appellant for the uncharged misconduct in well. Now, the military judge, admittedly, at this prior to the arguments, had said, essentially, the standard instruction about members, you are here to determine a sentence based on the offenses for which the accused has been found guilty. But it wasn't until after that instruction was given that the trial counsel made the comments that I read to you a moment ago about these girls have been waiting for justice, and members, basically, it's your duty to deliver justice for all three girls when you determine a sentence in this case. Regrettably, there was no objection by the defense counsel, so that means that I'm arguing to you today that that was plain error, both on the merits and on sentencing, for the trial counsel to continually hammer home to the members, both on the merits and on sentencing, that there were three victims in this case rather than two. It would have been permissible for the trial counsel to say this is a common theme, same MO, if the evidence supported that. But it was passing across that line and trying to impress upon the members that they had some obligation to render justice and then punish the appellant on behalf of a girl whose name was not on the charge sheet, who did not form the basis of any of the charges. We believe that the prejudice here on the merits of the case was that it contributed impermissibly to a finding of guilty of both of the charges, and with regards to sentencing, that it was an impermissible consideration for the panel.
How many photos were used?
It was the same, if I may, Your Honor, it was the same photograph used. On the merits, there was actual slideshow, so I imagine he was there with the clicker going through picture, picture, picture. But on sentencing, just if I may, I'm holding up appellate exhibit 36 and now 37, and then ultimately became 41.
And that's the photo in question that you're building your argument around.
And as I'm holding this up, it says at the top, stolen innocence, justice past due, which shows 9-year-old.
And how was it displayed at the before members? Was it displayed like that, or was it displayed on a screen, or does the record reflect?
The record's not clear on that, Your Honor. It was, I frankly have assumed that there was some type of projection screen that was used because it was depicted as a slideshow, and he made comments like next slide. So that suggested to me, reading the record, that it was on some type of a screen or a standard military white blank wall in the courtroom that he was displaying that.
And so we're talking about the one appellate exhibit, the photo or slide or whatever it is, and then a number of statements. Is that correct?
Yes, sir. It's
your universe of facts.
It is, Your Honor.
Yeah.
Counsel, I believe you've shown the court upon Exhibit 36, and if you wouldn't mind just giving counsel for the government a visual view of that, so they have a view of what it is you've shown the court.
My apologies.
Thanks.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel, you had just mentioned your prejudice arguments in regard to both merits and sentencing. Could you go back and go through that again?
Yes, Your Honor. As will become more evident when we argue the issue one on this case, the evidence against the government was, the government's case, I should say, against the appellant was based on this 1981 uncharged misconduct with 1987 uncharged misconduct and claimed that she had been raped in 1987, and then way down the line we have 2001 and these indecent, allegedly indecent acts involved. By arguing that the members had a duty to render justice for the 9-year-old girl from 1981, what he was in essence doing was, in our opinion, inflaming the members. And as the evidence develops on the additional issue, there was a great deal to feel sorry for as far as she had obviously led a rough life. She had some pretty serious mental health issues. And here's a picture of this sweet-looking girl at the age of 9, and the members being urged and goaded, if you will, to provide justice for this poor girl. In fact, poor girl is the term that the trial counsel used. Trial counsel even accused the defense of attempting to assassinate character by bringing out all these mental health issues she had. She believed that, for example, her child had been unpossessed by the clowns in a children's book, and that the spirit of Jim Morrison lived with her. She admitted she was on medication. She had been diagnosed as a schizophrenic. So all of this was a way of playing on the members' sympathy, if you will, to feel an exaggerated sense of pity, if you will, for on the merits, on sentencing, we believe that it came into play with regards to the sentence that was actually awarded. Admittedly, the government asked for 20 to 25. The defense, as I recall, asked, I think, between the 2 and 5 year range. Ultimately, the appellant received a 10-year sentence. And while when one looks at 20 to 25, that may not seem extreme, we'd invite the court's attention to the fact that this was a 50-year-old man that was in trial. And I would submit to the court that a 10-year sentence matters far more to a 50-year-old man than it would to a 20-year-old one. So we believe that it came into play in terms of the amount of confinement that the appellant received from the members during sentencing.
Can you go back to the military judge's instruction to the members? Do you contend that it was not sufficient on the law with respect to what the military members could consider on findings?
With regards to the argument of the trial counsel?
Yes, yeah, so with regard to the putative victims of the uncharged misconduct.
I'm sorry, Your Honor, I'm not sure I'm clear. Are we moving into the first issue now that you're addressing, or are we still just talking about the trial counsel's argument?
We're talking about the trial counsel's argument and what the military judge's instruction was with respect to what use they could make of it.
Oh, thank you, Your Honor. Well, the military judge gave the instruction before, actually he split the instructions up. He gave the standard, here's what you may consider part of the instructions. Then counsel argued, and then the judge gave the procedural, here's how you go out and do your vote instruction. So it was split as far as the substance and then the procedural part of the sentencing process. So in the first part, the military judge did say, you know, you have to determine a sentence based on the offenses for which the accused has been found guilty, But then the trial counsel stands up and he makes this passionate argument for justice for all three girls, which is the closing note with the photograph. And then at that point, it's our contention that the military judge should have instructed the members at that point that, hey, when you sentence of the appellant today, you can only sentence the appellant on the basis of the charged offenses, not because, unlike what the trial counsel says, there are really three victims here that you need to provide justice for in terms of your sentence. So I think it's the timing of when the military judges gave that basic instruction that's important here, because it preceded the trial counsel's argument. And the military judge took no action after the trial counsel's argument to clarify for the members what the position, what role Stacey should have played, if any, in their deliberations. Again, it would have been permissible for them to consider the uncharged.
Are you taking issue with the timing generally, or only in the context of this case where the photo then comes in?
Only in the context of this case, Your Honor.
So if the photo hadn't been introduced or the other comments, insert your facts here, you're not... This is a proper way for the judge to have instructed.
Yes, Your Honor, I think it is for him to say at the outset, here's what you're basically, here's your mission.
So you're arguing for the sua sponte duty to jump in here. What's your response to the notion or theory or the presumption that members are presumed to follow the instructions?
Well, I think that my response to that, Your Honor, would be that they took away from this without any clarification from the judge that it would be okay to listen to what the trial counsel was asking them to do. So I went back and looked at this panel. There, of the five members, only one previously had any court-martial panel member experience. So we had four neophytes on the panel who, if they followed it literally and totally disregarded the trial counsel's argument, perhaps we would engage in that presumption. But the fact is, in this case, the trial counsel did make improper argument. We do feel that it rises to the level of plain error, and the judge had a duty to jump in and say, hey, members, whoa, just a second, we need to clarify something about the trial counsel's argument. And that's the point that we pick, Your Honor, that the military judge should have done.
Does a military judge's duty to sua sponte instruct depend on or agreeing with you that this was plain error?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Does the military judge's duty, as you describe it, to give a sua sponte curative instruction depend on our agreeing with you that there was plain error?
Your Honor, we do contend that this was plain, meaning that it was obvious, and it was certainly on a material point, especially with regards to sentencing. So, yes, I do believe that there was that obligation of the judge to come in, both in his role as the gatekeeper and as the person that's solely responsible for the instructing the members on what they can consider when they go back to the sentencing deliberations.
Counsel, assuming that we would find that there was error and that it was plain and obvious, getting to the prejudice argument on sentencing, he was convicted of rape, which is life without possibility of parole is the maximum sentence. The government recommended less than that, and he ended up getting less than even what the government recommended. How are we to determine or consider that this increased whatever sentence that he had given both the maximum and given the recommendation of the government.
Again, Your Honor, I think that goes back to the age of the accused being very relevant here, the age of the appellant. 10 years is axiomatically just a more significant sentence.
But that's more of an impact on him personally. Are we supposed to look at prejudice here as to the defendant as we find him in his age, or are we supposed to look at prejudice as to the jury or the members' deliberations?
I think we actually have to take into account this particular accused, because we're looking at whether or not it materially impacted the substantial rights of an accused. And in this case, and looking at the totality of the circumstances, I think the age of the appellant, the accused in this case. In addition, Your Honor, though, I would point out that he had almost 30 years of exemplary service in the United States Air Force, was retirement eligible, and the retirement chart, which is at Defense Exhibit Alpha Mike, if I recall correctly, shows that his forfeitures were going to be a loss of over $1 million over his lifetime, projected by the finance people that sit down and crunch those numbers. So when you look at the total significance of the sentence that was given, again, we think the greatest impact where it was felt here was in terms of confinement. I think because of the rape charge, quite frankly, there was a very, very high likelihood he was walking out of the courtroom with a punitive discharge, and that would have included the loss of his retirement benefits. So the number to play with, if you will, for the panel members was going to be how much confinement. And we think that 10 years was a result of the trial counsel's argument on sentencing, Your Honor, especially with that photograph.
Where is your better prejudice argument, on merits or on sentencing?
I'm inclined to say on sentencing, because I actually have a hard number I can offer the court on that one, but I think it was critical on the merits part of the case as well. With merits, though, I have to admit that the trial counsel was entitled to argue that he had an intent theory that he was trying to sell to the members, and as a result of that, arguing one theme was okay based on the evidence that did come in. It was when he started to tackle members on the merits that they had some kind of duty, if you will, to render justice where he went too far. The 20 years common theme was probably okay, but where he was aligned with that part of the argument that had to do with the language regarding we owe it to those three girls, and then finishing with the language about don't forget about the victims, don't forget about again, if the three pictures that were presented to the members on that slideshow, the youngest one is portrayed, and again, it is a very sweet-looking child in that photograph who undoubtedly provoked a very strong emotional sentiment from the panel members, both on the merits and on sentencing.
And I didn't see it in your brief, but you have a cumulative prejudice argument that combined the argument on merits, the comments on merits, and the comments in the picture on sentencing. Is there a way to lump that together, or are they separate?
Well, I think they actually can be lumped together, to use the judge's terminology, because of the fact that the trial counsel used the same theme throughout the trial with regards to three victims, stolen innocence, justice deprived. It carried over with the same theme on sentencing. So I think that, that certainly the argument can be made that the appellant has a cumulative argument of his own that this was wrong from start to finish for the trial counsel to do that.
With respect to either issue one or two, do the Supreme Court decisions in Apprendi and Blakely have any bearing on what the responsibility is of the judge to instruct as to what findings have to be made by the members before they use the charge misconduct for the purpose of increasing a sentence? If that's not something that you've briefed or thought about, I don't want to delay.
I haven't actually thought about that, Your Honor, but I welcome the opportunity to file a supplemental pleading on that.
We're not asking for it, but I just leave the question there. Thank you,
Your Honor. If I may now, if there's no further questions on Issue 2, I'd like to turn to Issue 1, the central theme of which I've already touched on, and that is whether or not the military judge properly admitted this uncharged misconduct, some of which predated the most current charge on the charge sheet by 20 years, and then whether or not the military judge properly instructed the panel on its use. But with this issue, although this may seem not quite as logical as it should. I'd like to start with the flaw with the instruction given by the judge, because I see my time starting to run down here. Assuming, for the sake of argument, for this portion of my argument, that the military judge did properly let in all of the uncharged misconduct involving the court is still left with what the appellant considers to be a very inaccurate instruction to the panel members as to how to actually use that evidence. The military judge announced when he was doing the motion in limine at the outset of the record that he was going to give a 404B instruction, and he ultimately gave a 414 instruction. And then the labeling of what number instruction is given really isn't important in the great scheme of things. Obviously, it's the content of what's the instruction. And if we go back and look at the instruction that the military judge gave, it was each offense must stand on its own. The burden is on the prosecution to prove each and every element beyond a reasonable doubt. As a general rule, proof of one offense carries no inference that the accused is guilty of another offense. So far, so good. Pretty typical language. But the military judge inserted language of his own at this point. You may consider the similarities in the testimony of concerning any alleged offense touching with regard to the charged offense of rape and the similarities involved concerning the indecent acts charge. We believe, Your Honors, that this is wholly inadequate for this case. What we're talking about from
counsel, what is the purpose of 414? Why do we let this stuff in? Isn't it to show analogous conduct? Isn't it to show, leaving aside motive opportunity, which is pre-414, but what is the purpose of 414 if not to let the members draw this kind of inference?
Well, Your Honor, it is to let them draw, they can use it basically for any relevant purpose that they see fit. One member may think that it's important for propensity, and another member under 414 may think it's important for propensity.
Well, you're saying the instruction was inadequate.
I'm saying this instruction is inadequate.
What should he have said?
It did not go far enough, Your Honor. First of all, he did not explain to them why the similarities even matter. Did it matter because of intent? Propensity was never mentioned, but there was also nothing telling the members, hey, if you do consider it for propensity, here's how you should consider it for propensity. And the specific language that should have been in, at a minimum, his instruction is he never instructed the members that they could not convict merely because they believed he committed the uncharged misconduct, and they could not convict merely because they believe he had a propensity to engage in child molestation. That language is not of my own crafting. I stole it quite liberally from the Booch book instruction, which we believe the military judge should have given in lieu of this personally crafted similarities that the military judge apparently relied on from United States versus Drool. However, the bench book at this point in time did have very specific instruction at 7 TAC 13 TAC 1 in the bench book, which addressed sexual assault under 413 and child molestation under 414, as well as the use of charged misconduct from between, for example, the rape charge and the indecent acts charge. The common theme on these bench book instructions, though, is that language that I read to the court a minute ago, and that is that the military judge failed to instruct that the members could not convict merely because they believed he had committed the other acts involved or merely because they believed he had a propensity to engage in child molestation.
Counsel, with respect to the acts, the indecent acts, are you arguing that there were certain acts which, even if committed, were not subject to 414 and that might have been used by the members to convict?
Yes, Your Honor, that was...
Could you please, whatever detail you need, not necessarily going into graphic detail, describe those events which were not admissible under 414, which might have been used not covered under 414, which might have been used to convict for other offenses?
As I recall, Your Honor, from the brief, it was there were six acts alleged in the specification, and it was act number two and act number six. I think it was touching on the leg, which would not have qualified under 414, and then kissing on the neck, although jawline's probably a better description of the evidence. So those two acts, the language of those two acts does not fit within the qualifying language of MRE 414.
Okay, now with respect to the judge's responsibilities and balancing, does the judge have to determine whether the members could, by a preponderance of an evidence, find that an act took place?
Yes, Your Honor.
And did the judge instruct in this case the members that they had to make a finding by a preponderance?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Did the judge in this case instruct the members that they had to make such a finding by the preponderance of the evidence?
I do not recall him instructing on that, Your Honor. The only reference to the uncharged misconduct was in that similarities language that I read the court a moment ago. So
would that have been an error if the judge didn't instruct that they had to make a finding by a preponderance?
Well, we believe it certainly adds to the other reasons why the instructions were faulty in this case, Your Honor. So we certainly, we understand that issue one is rather a hodgepodge of sub-issues, but that was certainly one of the off ones that we believe the judge should have instructed on as well. My time is getting close. Let me just, if I may, leave the court with one visual image. Someone one time said to me that instructions are a lot like dumping the parts of a TV set in front of, I see my time has expired.
Please continue.
When you have evidence, you're putting it in front of the jury, and they're like the parts to a TV set. And the instructions from the military judge serve as the directions, if you will, to the members on how to put together that TV set. The problem in this case is if the court was even remotely confused, reading the briefs and keeping track of the differences between the evidence used for this purpose, for that purpose, admitted under this purpose, admitted there, one can only imagine how the panel must have felt trying to piece this up. If there are no further questions, I see my time.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal for
further. Thank you, sir.
Counsel, on rebuttal, will you take a look at the language in 414 that talks about, for the purposes of this rule, offense of child molestation means any offense punishable under the UCMJ that involved any sexual acts. Here we had four of the six that involved it in the same charge. By using the word involved, I wonder whether or not they required that all of the charged acts actually qualified. So you can just respond to that on rebuttal.
Thank you.
Counsel for the government.
May it please the court. Judge Efron, honorable members of the court, good morning. My name is Major Jemima Eason. I, along with Colonel Gerald Bruce, represent the United States in this proceeding. With the court's indulgence, we're going to start with issue one because it builds up as to why counsel argued the way he argued in issue two. Issue one, the military judge did not err when he allowed uncharged acts into evidence under MRE 414. MRE 414 allows this type of evidence, if the defendant has been charged with an offense of sexual molestation, and that the evidence was that another offense of sexual molestation. Here, the appellant, of course, was charged with indecent acts with a child and rape. Both are offenses of child molestation. The uncharged acts that were brought forth into evidence were the indecent acts against his stepdaughter, by him touching her vagina and her breast, as well as the indecent acts of his, natural daughter, by him committing the same acts, plus forcible sodomy.
Counsel, does 414 allow evidence of an indecent act which doesn't meet the definition in 414F to come in? It may come in under some other rule, but just talking about 414 itself.
The United States believes that it does, Your Honor. And
what's the purpose of the rule, then, 414F?
Well, 414F, we do not believe that those definitions are all inclusive.
So 414F means the term sexual contact does not mean only the intentional touching. The government would insert the word only in there. Includes but not as limited to those types of words that might be used.
Under 414F, sexual contact means intentional touching either directly through clothing, genitalia, anus, groin, breast, inner thigh, or buttocks of any person with an intent to abuse or arouse or gratify the sexual desire of any person. We understand that that could be one reading of 414F, and we're taking that, those two particular acts, the placing his hand upon her leg and kissing upon her neck, appear to meet that definition. However, 414F is, the United States believes, is an extension of 404B. 404B would allow that type of evidence to come in for intent.
That wasn't my question. If it comes in under 404B, you don't have to worry about 414. So we're talking about evidence that is not otherwise admissible. That is the evidence for which 414 was created, to allow in evidence that wasn't otherwise admissible. Not intent evidence. It just happened. No intent, no pattern, nothing that would come in under 414. Now, is it the government's position that this court should, in effect, look at the purpose of 414 and not as a whole, and not worry about the specific words of 414F and apply that mode of statutory and regulatory interpretation to the rule 414?
It is, because the purpose behind rule 414 was to allow evidence of sexual molestation. Here, the charged acts of placing his hand upon her leg was done with the intent to gratify one's sexual desire. So, in essence, it is an offense of child molestation, although not specifically defined under 414.
And is that the position of the United States as to how this court should interpret the manual for courts martial, that we should not worry about specific definitions that have words in them like means, and then look at those words as the boundary of the definition, but instead in the way we should interpret all portions of the manual for the courts martial, is to look at the purpose of a particular section or the purpose of the code as a whole and come up with whatever meaning that this court thinks is appropriate.
Your Honor, we believe that you should look at the purpose behind the rule.
Thank you.
So just to be clear, your response to Judge Erdman's question at the closing of the first side, which was if four of the six acts, stipulating that four of the six acts are qualify under the rule and two don't, and you don't have to accept that. Your response is all six acts qualify. Or is your response four of the six qualify, and since four come in, the other two get come in as well because the overall offense is one involving child molestation? Or is your response none of them should come in because the judge didn't instruct us with respect to each of the six? You see what I'm doing? My concern is that I want to pin down what exactly your response to Judge Heffron was.
I understand. Our position is that all six should qualify under the rule because they are offenses of child molestation. The United States understands that two of the six may not fit the definition. But even in the alternative, four of the six do fit the definition. And this is one specification, one charge. So because four of the six, for sure.
But I understand, to be clear, I understand you also saying that if the sole charge there was put his hand on her leg, period, full stop, qualifies under 414. Is that your position?
It would be our position,
okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Counsel, what's the standard that the judge has to apply in determining whether there is factual sufficiency for the existence of a act that would qualify under 414?
Whether the members of the panel could reasonably find by preponderance of the evidence that the uncharged acts actually occurred.
And did the judge in this case instruct the members that they had to find by a preponderance of the evidence?
No, Your Honor. And, no, Your Honor.
Is he required to give that instruction, or is he just required to consider that point when deciding whether or not to let the information in?
We believe that he's required to consider that point. Requiring to let the information in.
What determination do the members have to make then? Do they have to apply any standard to determine whether the event simply occurred, or is it sufficient that they hear evidence and the fact that evidence was given is enough for them to rely on it without making any determination?
To judge the credibility of a witness. So if the members find that the stepdaughter or the natural daughter are credible, then they'll give the appropriate weight to their testimony and whether or not the uncharged actually occurred.
Is your answer then that they consider it like they do any other evidence?
Yes, Your Honor.
Why would the standard be that the judge has to determine that the members could decide by a preponderance and the members aren't required to decide by a preponderance? What sense would that make? In other words, would the judge have to consider that the members could decide by a preponderance, but the members can simply hear the evidence and decide, well, we heard that, we'll consider it.
I think the military judge is making a factual determination that the members could find, reasonably find by a preponderance of the evidence. I don't think that the members find that. But so long as the judge believes that the members could reasonably make that determination or make that finding, that's the standard to allow that into evidence.
Is it a gatekeeping provision that the military judge has to make an assessment as to when he'll even let the evidence in, as opposed to keep it out entirely?
Yes, Your Honor.
And the rule doesn't say anything at all about what the members have to do?
No, Your Honor. Specifically what the judge must find. And I know from this court that this case, more or less, if not on point, is very similar to United States v. Durrell. The military judge in Durrell did the same analysis. And the military judge in the case of Judas gave pretty much the very same instruction that the military judge in Durrell gave. And this honorable court found that the instruction given by the military judge in Durrell was adequate for the members to make a determination on findings of guilt, for instance.
Was the standard in the instruction at issue in Durrell?
No, it was not at issue.
Okay, thank you.
Nevertheless, the military judge in this case conducted proper 4-3 balancing tests using the factors set forth in United States versus Wright. He gave detailed findings of fact as well as his conclusions of law on pages 64 through 75 that this honorable court can look at. The court gives wide discretion when the military judge conducts a balancing test under 403, and the military judge did not err in admitting the uncharged acts under 414. because the military judge did not err in admitting the uncharged acts under 414, the trial counsel's argument in Issue 2 was entirely proper. We note that this honorable court should take into consideration trial counsel's entire argument and not certain portions or just one or two portions. We note that the argument consisted of approximately 40 pages, and in rebuttal, it consisted of 16 pages as far as findings are concerned. And in the findings argument, trial counsel appropriately argued that the members could use the uncharged acts against the stepdaughter as well as the uncharged acts of the natural daughter.
Are you arguing prejudice or error with respect to the photo? If the trial counsel's argument consisted of nothing more than the photo, members, I want to leave you with just one thought. And here's a picture, Stolen Innocence, Justice Past Due, with the three people. Would that be error?
No, I think you have to look at the context of the argument.
Is there a standard instruction regarding which what you're sentenced for? Aren't you supposed to be sentenced for what you're convicted for?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, so is it appropriate, in the abstract, is it appropriate to be sentenced for other bad things you've done?
No, but it does go to rehabilitative potential, so.
Now, my hypothetical was a hypothetical.
I understand.
If the whole thing consisted of nothing more than the picture, picture speaks 1,000 words or whatever, so trial counsel gets up and says, I have just one thing to refresh you on, this picture.
That's good.
I'm trying to just dissect to make sure what part of your argument goes to prejudice and what part goes to error.
If the argument consists of nothing more but the picture.
Right.
Of the three young ladies, young girls.
Right, and I can beef up the hypothetical to make it easier. Give these three justice.
That would be error.
Okay. Why would it be error?
Because in essence, we're arguing for a sentence based on something that the appellant has not been convicted of, arguably.
Would there be prejudice if the sentence were the same as in this actual case?
There was no prejudice.
Well, assuming error, you just said to Judge Baker, under that hypothetical, there would have been error. I'm saying, okay, given that hypothetical with the same sentence, was there prejudice?
For capital.
Just for the record, I was asking the error part there. This is on him.
Yeah, it's on me.
If I may, and shoot me down, given these facts, I guess, instead of just taking that in the abstract, it's difficult to take that in the abstract and say that it's a prejudicial argument.
Okay. Was there prejudice in this case, assuming plain error?
No, Your Honor. There was no prejudice.
Why wasn't there?
The appellant was convicted of raping his daughter, his 12-year-old daughter. And he was also convicted of some indecent acts. Obviously, the rape is the most egregious offense that he committed. And as this honorable court is aware, it's a sentence that could has a maximum punishment of life in prison. Trial counsel argued only 20 to 25 years, and he received 10 years. There was definitely no prejudice. In this case,
what bearing does the life imprisonment for rape have on prejudice? We see cases here, rape, 1 year, 1.5 years, 3 years. How do we have any idea at this level was prejudicial based upon the maximum of life in a rape case. We also see 80 years life. We see them all over the place. How do we assess as a court whether there's prejudice?
The impact on the victims, which it had a substantial impact on his natural daughter, who has been going through therapy, who's had mental health issues, protection of society. This is someone who has, and this is why the uncharged acts are important, because this is someone who's shown himself to do this, and if not punished adequately, will continue to do this.
Isn't that a function for the Court of Criminal Appeals in the case of error to take those matters into account?
Yes, I mean, and they did in affirming the sentence.
But they determined there was no error. My recollection.
So we're
proceeding in this level of questioning. And you're not conceding error, and we're not stating that there's error, but assuming that there was error with respect to showing the picture of the third child and arguing for justice for the third child. Then the question is, if that had been error, then why shouldn't we send this back for the Court of Criminal Appeals, to the Court of Criminal Appeals, for them to engage in this balancing of the remaining evidence and determine whether they can reassess the sentence or have to order a rehearing? That's their unique function here, not ours. But what is there in this case that would say, no, you can keep it here with confidence?
The fact that there was no, if there was error, then the error was harmless.
Right, but what do we look at to determine in this case it's harmless, where you have the trial counsel putting up the picture of the third person and pointing to the third person, asking for justice for the third person? I'm not asking you to concede error in that regard, but assuming that that is error, what would lead this court to say, despite those errors, there's no need to send this to the Court of Criminal Appeals for them to engage in sentence reassessment? Sentence reassessment, after all, doesn't mean that they would necessarily reduce the sentence. They could look at it and say, balancing all those factors, that's sufficient. For us to look at it, we have to say there's no need for that balancing because the error is harmless as to sentencing. So what would lead us to conclude that the error would be harmless in this case? Assuming error.
Again, the facts that were admitted into evidence, that is the impact on the victims, and not just that, everything, the character of the appellant, his history.
Counsel, do you understand the Chief Judge's concern, which is that, I understand what you're saying, that we could look at the facts and see, what has happened in this case, but you understand his point and his concern, which is that there are often cases of rape that have sentences that are nowhere near 10 years.
Yes, Your Honor.
And that it's difficult for an appellate, for this court, to make those judgments.
I do understand that, Your Honor. The one thing I just don't want to do is concede that there was any type of error that was.
We're not asking you to concede that. We're proceeding simply on the assumption that if there's error, and we're strictly looking at prejudice here, that is, you rule out the consideration of the asking for justice and looking at the picture of the third person here. We have not made a determination that there's error here, and we're not asking you to concede that.
That's a difficult question. I do understand that the practice of this court is to send it back for assessment or reassessment.
Not in every case. There are cases where we keep it here. What would the government's argument be for keeping it here and finding it harmless?
Is it possible for you to argue it? I'm not suggesting that you can, but I'm asking you, can you argue that this was such an insignificant point in the sentencing argument that it had no impact? And that's the argument I think you have to make. And I'd like to hear you try, but...
Right. That's the argument that I want to make, but then the follow-up question, I guess it's almost like a chess game. Well, how do we know it didn't have any impact? And the best that I can answer that question would be the sentence that was given to the appellant of only 10 years for these offenses. That's the best answer that I have for this court.
See, you can't argue that this was such an insignificant portion of his sentencing thing that it had no bearing on what the members gave him.
Well, it was an insignificant portion. I mean, but given the hypothetical, and I'm assuming the hypothetical, it was just those pictures and nothing more.
We're not doing the case. I'm going to return to the hypothetical whenever you're done with this. They're doing the real case.
Yeah. Right. We're not asking the hypothetical here. To the extent there's a hypothetical, it's to assume that we have found that there was error. We're not creating a hypothetical in the sense of asking you to consider other facts or circumstances. Facts of this case. Assuming that the error consisted of putting the picture of the other young woman in and asking for justice for her, if you take those out, then is your argument simply that 10 years is well within the range that someone would receive for this, even if there had been error in the case? Or is your argument that 10 years plus something else?
10 years is something that is adequate, is an adequate sentence for this particular appellant, for these particular...
But that's not our call. We don't decide sentence appropriateness or sentence adequacy here. We have to decide whether it's harmless that it did not have the impact.
He would receive that regardless.
Why?
Because it was such a small, I mean, it wasn't really even a part of his argument, other than the fact that he had a picture on the screen. The crux of his argument dealt with his daughter, the two victims in the case, his daughter and the neighbor, not the stepdaughter and the uncharged acts.
Returning to the hypothetical that has been very helpful to you, in not assuming error, if we now take that picture, the abstract question was, if all the argument was that picture, with that argument, say, look at this, justice denied, you now bring that in and drop it into a larger argument with other things, none of them improper. Why, taking this error and moving it into here, why is this error or not? On the one hand, on the other hand. Give me on the one hand, on the other hand. Because we've stipulated on the hypothetical that if it consisted of nothing more than that picture, say, give justice to these three people, that would be error. You've said so. We now move this over here and go, dunk, into any other argument, all of it proper. Not prejudice, but why is this now error or not error?
Well, it's not
error. On the one hand, on the other hand.
It's not error because he's not advocating or arguing for sentence based on the uncharged misconduct. He didn't argue that in this particular case.
Oh, no, I'm sorry. Have you tracked in the hypothetical still?
Okay, with the hypothetical...
Do you want me to sprinkle in some more facts and mix them up a little? The hypothetical is, give justice to these three people. Into the larger argument now. Error or not error?
It's still not error. I mean, choice, because the third person, if you will, could be a representative of society. I mean, it depends on the argument, but the pictures themselves.
Okay, I'll let you off the hook on this hypothetical. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Counsel, you stated a few minutes ago that the inclusion of the references to the stepdaughter was a minimal part of the case. But as I read it, it was a major part of the government's theme, both in opening when they said this is a case about a man who raped his daughter, molested his stepdaughter. She's not a victim in this case. The accused abused his power and authority as a father, as a stepfather. Again, I'm talking about three girls, common theme. All the way through here, they're talking about the stepdaughter as though she were a victim of charged conduct in this case. Now, what I'm trying to figure out is how that is not error, as you have been arguing that that is not error. Is it your argument that once that evidence comes in under 414, it can be used as if it were charged conduct as far as the arguments go? Can trial counsel use it that way?
No, I think they can use it for propensity, because that's what it's designed for, and that's what the members can consider it.
But here it appears that in the trial counsel's argument, he is putting them in one package. He is saying we have three victims rather than two victims and one girl who was, you know, that were on charge acts against that you can use for propensity. There's no differentiation there, and so the members are getting, if they're believing it, it's making this guy look worse than he would were the stepdaughter's acts not included.
But the members are aware also with the military judge's instructions that they were to sentence him for the acts that he's been found guilty of.
And the fact that the trial counsel, in all of his arguments, includes the stepdaughter with the victims doesn't make any difference.
No.
Okay. Thank you.
I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Chief Judge, if I might, I'd like to return to the Apprendi and Blakely question that you posed earlier, and just mulling it over at the table. What came to mind with regards to how those two cases might impact on whether or not the judge had to give a sua sponte instruction about the argument of the trial counsel, it actually called to mind this court's recent decision, if I'm pronouncing this correctly, in Moffitt, M-O-F-F-E-I-T, where there was a discussion by the author judge, if I recall correctly, about the ability of appellate judges to conduct sentence assessment, reassessment, and of course that's not the issue immediately in this argument, but there was a reference to how in the military justice system there is almost unfettered discretion that is given to the sentencing authority, in this case five panel members, four of whom had never sat on a court-martial before. So your question about Apprendi and Blakely calls to mind that in the military there is such, there are no sentencing guidelines, the panel is given such a wide range of options for punishment, from no punishment at all, which realistically was not going to happen in this case, to the rape charge, which carried a potential sentence of life without parole. So the Chief Judge's question about Apprendi and Blakely brought that discussion in Moffitt to mind. With regard to your question, Judge Erdman, it's true that 414, as you pointed out, doesn't use the word involved. But in answer to your question, I'd ask to look back at the history of how our jurisprudence in this country has historically frowned on propensity evidence, and only with the introduction of 413 and 414 10 or 11 years ago was the door narrowly open to allow some degree of propensity evidence in a small number of cases, mainly sexual assault and sexual molestation. And it's the position of the appellant that unless you fit squarely within one of these defined acts within 414, then the government does not get the benefit of propensity or any other purpose under 414 for acts which do not fit within that definition of sexual conduct or sexual acts.
So was the charge bad from the outset? Was that specification bad from the outset in your view?
I don't think the charge, the specification was bad. I just don't think that 414 applied to all six acts under it. I certainly see the government being able to charge all six of those acts based on what had been presented at the Article 32, so I don't find any flaw with the specification itself, just with the government's efforts to use use 414 for all six.
Could they use propensity for four of the six?
Arguably, yes, sir.
So what they should have done is charged two specifications? That's the preferred course from the appellant's perspective?
Not necessarily, Your Honor. I think what the judge's duty here was, although it would have added more instructions to our already lengthy instructions, would be to say you can consider, for these four acts that the appellant is charged with in determining whether or not those were indecent, but you cannot consider that with regards to these other two acts, namely the kissing on the neck and the, I want to say, the touching of the leg, because it didn't specify the inner thigh. Inner thigh would have qualified, the leg does not, under 414. And if there are no further questions,
I have one question.
Sure.
With your statement on prejudice earlier with respect to the age of the accused, aren't you in essence asking us to decide sense appropriateness there, something that is reserved to the CCAs?
No, sir. I think what it does go back to is this court's determination of whether or not it was harmless. And I think that is a significant factor for the court to take into consideration. As the Chief Judge pointed out, some rape cases before this court, a year, two, three-year sentence, and here we have a 50-year-old who receives a 10-year sentence for rape and for these indecent acts, which on their face are not indecent on the charge sheet. It's only the context of the other evidence that convinced the jury to regard them as indecent and find in their verdict.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for their presentation. Today, this case is now submitted, and we will stand in recess until 10 minutes after 10 o'clock. Welcome, counsel, to our somewhat chilly courtroom. If a recess is needed at any time, please let us know. Otherwise, we will call the United States against Beatty, counsel for the defense.
United States Beatty v. Beatty, this court has granted review on a somewhat limited issue, and that issue being whether or not the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals properly conducted an Article 66 review in this case. And with this narrow scope of review, what I'd like to do is sort of talk about the historical background of this case and then tell you why the answer in this case is clear. The answer is clearly in the affirmative. As you know, members of the court, this case was tried approximately 2002. The appellant was convicted. The defense filed a petition for new trial based on an affidavit by the alleged victim, the accused adopted daughter. A debate hearing was held. The defense filed a petition for new trial and a brief based both on the debate hearing and a factual and legal sufficiency brief to the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. That court, in reaching its decision, indicated that they considered matters which were outside of the record. This is how we know the answer to the granted issue in this case. The question being whether or not the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals considered matter outside of the record, well, we know that they do. And we know that they do because, quite frankly, they told us that they did. The Air Force Court conducted a very brief, limited factual and legal sufficiency review of this case, consisting of all of three paragraphs in response to a somewhat over 20-page brief filed by the defense. In that brief, the defense pointed out numerous errors and numerous factual gaps within the alleged victim's testimony. And the Air Force Court, in this three-paragraph analysis in affirming the appellant's conviction, spent one of those paragraphs talking about matters that are outside outside of the record. The Air Force Court specifically referenced two pretrial Article 39A sessions, as well as the pre-sentencing testimony of the alleged victim, and stated words to the effect of that her testimony at trial and in these two pretrial 39As and in the pre-sentencing phase was entirely consistent. They used this language in two different areas. They used it both in affirming the appellant's conviction as being factually and legally sufficient and in denying the petition for new trial. In the language addressing the petition for new trial, the Air Force Court stated that her testimony was consistent throughout the proceedings and again referenced the two areas, or the three areas, excuse me, outside the hearing of the members. So, in a strange sense, we already know the answer to the granted question in this case. Did the Air Force Court consider material outside of the record of trial and outside of the evidence presented to the members? We know the answer to that question to be yes.
Wait, is that how you should word the question, though?
Well, the question that the court asked is whether or not they conducted a proper review.
No, but is that the right language? Are we looking to what's the meaning of the entire record, or are we looking to what's the meaning of what was presented to members? If you ask the question what was presented to members, then it's pretty clear what the result is, isn't it?
It is, Your Honor.
But is the entire record, does that consist of something more than what was presented to them? Isn't that what you need to address?
Which I will in a second.
Okay.
I think both the Holt and the Mason cases.
I was just making sure you weren't sneaking the old straw man up there.
No, sir. We'll be addressing that in just a few seconds.
Also, you just referenced the petition for new trial and the denial there. Is the petition for new trial even before us today?
To be quite honest with the court, I'm not entirely sure. It appears that it is not. It appears that the court is limiting the review today to the Article 66. I prepared some comments on the petition for new trial just simply in case the court had any questions for it, for me. Now, Judge Baker, in response to your question, the real question is, what is the proper scope of review, and what can the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals consider? Can they consider matters from these two pre-trial 39A sessions and the pre-sentencing hearing? And the answer to that question appears to be just as definitively no. And the appellant bases that on two cases that seem to squarely address the issue, which is U.S. v. Holt and U.S. v. Mason. U.S. v. Mason states specifically that the legal review is In reviewing guilt, evidence excluded in a trial form cannot be considered on appeal to affirm guilt. That's the Mason decision. The Holt decision says that the Article 66 review limits the Court of Appeals to a review of the facts, testimony, and evidence presented during the trial and prevents the Court of Criminal Appeals from considering extra record matters when making determinations of guilt.
Counsel, leaving those cases aside, could you address the specific language in Article 66, which refers to the record in each case under subsection B, as to what is to be forwarded? You're not suggesting that the material that the CCA looked at was not included in the record that was forwarded to them?
Oh, no, not at all, Your Honor. They certainly didn't take things that weren't in the record.
And isn't it fair to say that the record in each case is precisely the entire record that is referenced in subsection C?
Well, I would have to grab a quick copy of the manual, Your Honor, but I have 66C in front of me, and it says the court may act only with respect to the findings and sentence.
No, please do grab the whole manual. This is important. Whether and how you read these sections together is an important aspect.
Okay, and your specific question again, Judge?
My specific question is, it says, is what does it mean by entire record on the basis of this? I understand, I'm not disagreeing, but you're not suggesting that the CCA affirmed a finding or a sentence that wasn't approved by the convening authority, right?
Oh, no, Your Honor, not at all.
And so I'm directing your attention to the next sentence, which talks about on the basis of the entire record. And I'm asking you, what is the entire record? And isn't that something different than what you'd like us to look at, which is the evidence that was considered by the court-martial members?
Not as 66B and 66C have been interpreted by this court in both the Holt and the Mason decisions.
Did they address facts like this case?
Holt addressed fairly similar facts in the sense that the Court of Criminal Appeals stated that they were going to look at, they were going to apply a different evidentiary standard than applied by the trial court and as the evidence was presented to the members. And this court clearly said that they cannot do that, that the Article 66 review is limited to that evidence which was squarely before the members.
Okay, and what I'm asking to do is, assuming that Holt and Mason have not been decided, and just looking at the language of the statute, you know, what does the language of the statute tell us to do, tell us that the CCA can do?
Reading as I speak, Your Honor. It says on the basis of the entire record. Now, Your Honor, I think it's important. I haven't really thought about this issue, but as you bring it up, I think it's important to realize that the entire record is, as a record is accumulated by people on the government side. And I think that you have to look at this within the realities of, the court has to place some proper limitations on it. And it would be impossible for a court of criminal appeals to conduct a factual review of the evidence without giving the defense the opportunity to, you know, to review all of the evidence and without the defense being clear as to which evidence the Court of Criminal Appeals was going to consider. And so I think it has to be limited to the testimonial and evidentiary matters presented before the trier of fact. And that is the way that I would read the entire record, because otherwise matters that aren't even litigated in a 39A, for example, pretrial statements of individuals, could be used by a Court of Criminal Appeals in conducting a factual and legal sufficiency review. And I think clearly they could not do so because it would not be subject to cross-examination by the defense.
So do you think then that a CCA can't consider defects in the Article 32 investigation or improper decisions made with respect to pretrial motions and things of that nature because they weren't considered by the trier of fact?
Consider in the sense of if those matters were litigated before a judge in terms of legal errors raised or considering determining actual legal sufficiency, I would argue on the latter that based on my reading of the manual, and again, I know you don't want me to consider Holden and Mason, but they seem to both clearly say no. And so I think that the review has to be limited to the evidentiary matters presented before the members. Because otherwise, as I said, Your Honor, you'll be looking at police reports, you'll be looking at CID reports, at unsworn statements. Police gather a lot of material in presenting a case to prosecutors, and not the majority of that is never presented to the members.
Well, is the majority of it always contained in the record?
It is, Your Honor, actually. MP reports, CID reports, and that sort of matter are, in my experience, included in the record of trial almost universally.
If they're part of the Article 32 investigation, I mean, they have to be attached to something.
Actually not, Your Honor, because those matters, I think, they may be considered by a convening authority determining whether or not to prefer charges. So they may be matters, and you know, the entire CID report, in my experience, is generally included in the record of trial.
Just to be clear, your position then would also be that if those matters reflected innocence, they would also be excluded from the CCA's review.
And I know that my brother in the defense bar are probably going to be angry at me for making this argument today, but I think that it has to be. I think that the review has to be limited to those matters properly before the members.
I'm not sure that the breadth of the statement is what Holt and Mason are about. If the military judge has ruled that certain evidence is inadmissible, routinely the Court of Criminal Appeals will consider the correctness of that ruling. And if the military judge's ruling was incorrect in the view of the Court of Criminal Appeals, they will consider that in determining whether to order any relief, to dismiss the charges or order a rehearing. So perhaps the manner in which the granted issue is stated has a greater breadth. That is, I'm not aware of any case that stands for the proposition that the Court of Criminal Appeals can't consider everything that's between the blue covers for some purpose. And the question is, for what purpose are they considering it? That is, if the military judge ruled that certain evidence was inadmissible and that other evidence was admissible, could the Court of Criminal Appeals affirm a finding of guilty by saying the military judge erred in everything that he admitted before the members, but those things he didn't admit are sufficient to show guilt, and so we're going to sustain the conviction?
Your Honor, I will admit that when you granted review in this case, I was kind of curious as to what the scope was, and now I think it's becoming clearer, and I appreciate that. I think that the question that the court raises, I was just trying to address to Judge Ryan, I don't think that the granted issue would in any way preclude this court from resolving evidentiary matters presented to it at trial. I guess the best example, the one that comes to mind, is let us assume, for example, a 412 motion was argued at trial, and the military judge says that that evidence of, you know, alleged acts on behalf of an alleged victim could not be presented to a trier of fact. And then, that issue can clearly be re-litigated at trial. Now, I understand your question to be, can the court then look at that and say, if that had been properly decided, what would the result have been?
Let me ask it a different way, and I can't speak for my colleagues here. Each judge will decide for himself or herself what the granted issue means. My question is, can the Air Force Court, can a Court of Criminal Appeals rely for purposes of affirming a conviction on matters that are within the record, but which were not admitted into evidence at the trial?
And I think the answer to that question is clearly no.
And what's the basis for your answer there?
I think the basis is a reasonable reading of Article 66C, because, again, as I was just relating to Judge Ryan, the matters that get put into a record of trial are voluminous. And I think it would also open up, quite frankly, the potential for abuse of government putting things into a record that were never even seen by the defense, or that were at least not litigated, I should say, by, you know, at trial at all. And that's why I think that both Holt and Mason clearly, you know, state that that review has to be limited to, in terms of factual and legal sufficiency review, has to be limited to those matters properly presented at trial to give the appellant a reasonable and fair shake at arguing this case on appeal and knowing which matters the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to rely upon.
Do you take record? Do you take the CCA opinion as stating? You seem to say that the CCA stated flatly that it relied on these matters on the merits to determine the factual sufficiency of the evidence.
That is how I read their opinion, Your Honor.
Isn't it at best ambiguous?
Well, I don't think it is ambiguous, Your Honor, but if it is, the Washington case, and I'm trying to make sure I get this right, it's either Washington or Holt, in which Judge Ogden said that if it is ambiguous, you have to remand it for a further review.
Right, and shouldn't we simply do that? I mean, what are you asking us to do today? What do you want?
Well, I think that the only remedy at this point is if this court is unclear as to whether or not the Court of Criminal Appeals considered extra record matter. And if this court concludes that they should not consider extra record matter, then the only remedy is a remand that says you have to conduct a new Article 66 review, making it clear to us that you did not consider these materials.
For purposes, again, just this, the breadth of the wording, would you have the same problem if the Court of Criminal Appeals said in a case, here's the evidence that we rely on, it's all evidence that was admitted. By the way, that was admitted. By the way, although we don't rely on it, we know, since we're an appellate court and we can write whatever we want, that it's consistent with matters that were not admitted.
I think that would be essentially using the same language that they used in the Washington case as they were discussing whether or not the proper standard was beyond a reasonable doubt. And they said, we don't think that the presumption of innocence applies at trial or applies on appeal. We considered both standards in this case, and using both of those standards, we still affirm the appellant's conviction. And this court said, you know, as Judge Stuckey just mentioned, we're not clear as to whether or not you apply the proper standard, and we therefore have to remand the case.
I think in Washington it wasn't that we said that they couldn't say that as an extra matter, is that there was such emphasis and length given to one aspect of the opinion that the court lacked confidence at that.
And in this particular case, I think we have that same problem, Judge. We have one-third of the analysis of factual and legal sufficiency being dedicated to matters that are outside the record of trial. I would consider that to be a pretty significant amount of the court's opinion being spent on matters that they should not have considered.
Are you saying outside the record of trial or outside the matter that was admitted on the issue of guilt or innocence?
The latter, Your Honor, outside of those matters considered by the members.
You're saying that one-third of the lower court's opinion is talking about matters outside the record considered by the members?
Of their analysis of the factual and legal sufficiency, which is only three paragraphs, Judge, so it's pretty, I mean, one of the reasons I went to law school is I'm really bad at math, but there's three paragraphs devoted to factual and legal sufficiency, one of which deals with the two pretrial 39As and the pre-sentencing phase. So that's why I'm saying, at least as it relates to the issue that this court has asked me to address, a pretty substantial portion of a fairly short portion of the Air Force Court's opinion.
You're talking about the paragraph that also refers to her testimony on the merits? The one that said J.B. was 17 years old?
Yes, Your Honor.
So your third is just dividing it up by paragraphs?
Three paragraphs, one of which addresses.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure I understood your model.
Yes, and part of that may be, again, my lack of math aptitude. Now, members of the court, it's fairly clear as to the rationale behind limiting this review, as Judge Ryan and I were just discussing, behind limiting this review to those matters presented at trial. An appellant cannot get a de novo review of new evidence. If Article 66 means anything, it means that this court, that Congress and the President have given the courts of appeal all this awesome deplenary de novo power of review that we talk about. And if it's going to mean anything, it has to mean that that review is limited to those matters properly presented to the trials of fact. And again, Your Honors, I would argue that both Holt and Washington at least allude to, if not flatly state, that that has to be the standard, and that in this case, a remand is the appropriate remedy. Now, if there's subject to any further questions of the members of the court. Okay. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. You have an opportunity for rebuttal. Counsel for the government.
Chief Judge Ruffin, honorable members of the court. My name is Captain Jefferson E. McBride, and together with Colonel Gerald R. Bruce, representing the United States government in this matter. Now, I've got three prongs for my argument. The first prong is that appellant really misstates what the opinion says. It's our contention that the Air Force Court didn't consider the matters referenced in the opinion, that is, the pretrial motion section and the sentencing section. It's simply background extra information. And what I want the court to look at, and I think exemplifies that fact, is that concerning the motion for the petition for new trial, you can see clearly, and that's miscellaneous document number 2006-03, which is attached to the record of trial that came to this court. In that opinion, authored by Judge Schmidt, who also wrote the opinion later on the actual appellate issues, it's the first paragraph, the second substantive paragraph, is labeled background. And in that paragraph, he enumerates exactly what we're talking about here. He says, the appellate court-martial was held in late 02. The charges and specifications were based on J.B.'s allegations. She was 17 years old when she testified, and she was unwavering in her account of the appellant's actions. J.B. testified four times under oath during the course of the proceeding, twice during pretrial motion practice, once in the merits, and once in pre-sentencing. Now, when you fast forward to the actual decision, you can see that that exact language, and this is the beginning of the legal and factual sufficiency portion, That exact language is really just cut and pasted into this. And so presumably this is the background information that Judge Smith wanted to continue to give in his opinion here. And that's simply what it is, just opinion. Then he goes on right after he talks about the motion practice and the merits of the sentencing, and then he talks about what actually was in the findings phase. There's none of this information here that he talks about in the subsequent paragraph, and it's not a third of the opinion, it's simply two sentences.
Counsel, I'm sorry. Is the factual information contained in the majority of paragraph 3 and 4 on page 3 of the lower court's opinion, is that all information that is contained that was presented at trial?
Yes, Your Honor, it is.
Is any of that information information that was presented at the pretrial motions?
There is a portion of a pretrial motion that involved whether or not they could put in the photos of the appellant here with regards to the piercings. The judge did call her up and have her elucidate how did you see and all that stuff. So as far as the stuff about the penis, there is some information in the pretrial motion.
But the specific quotation, it's in paragraph 4 on page 3, where they appear to be quoting from JB's testimony at something. Where does that precise language come from? He has two piercings on, etc.
That comes from the findings in the case.
That was from her testimony?
It was from her testimony.
Exclusively? That was the only time she referenced that?
No, again, in the pretrial motion, she did do a little bit with regards to the penis identification.
But is this language, this precise language that's referenced in the opinion, does this precise language, is it found in the pretrial motion?
Yes, it's...
Do you understand my
question? I don't think it's that precise language. I think this language comes from the findings portion.
Aren't they using this stuff for credibility?
Well...
It's a neutral question. I don't know if that's a trick question.
I don't think so. I mean, I do intend on going...
She's unwavering in her account of appellant's actions. That seems to be an assessment as to her credibility as a witness, is it not? There's no trick here.
No, I understand. But in light of, after looking at when you were talking about the Dubé and talking about the petition from the trial, that was information originally generated from that, and that was important for him to put in the background information when he was addressing the petition from the trial. I think this is simply just the background information that he used in the cutting and pasting or whatever he did.
And they just chose to put it under a paragraph heading called Legal and Factual Sufficiency? Rather than background? That's the government's argument?
That's our position, man. I think it makes sense in that regard, because then you look back further with the petition for new trial, and he's talking about locating what happened during the findings at court. That same language appears there as it does in the Air Force.
Could you focus, without you conceding that argument, could you focus on if indeed the CCA is drawing on JV's testimony in four different contexts to make a credibility assessment regarding her allegations or regarding the witness, why is that or is it, why is it or is it not part of the entire record? And then why is it or is it not appropriate for the CCA to use it for factual sufficiency review rather than legal sufficiency review?
Well, at first blush on Article 56C, it does appear that language allows for the entire review from blue cover to blue cover to decide the legal and factual sufficiency. But as opposing counsel has pointed out, Holt, Pethea, Mason, those cases seem to confine to some degree the review. So in this case, however, it's the government's contention that this is the kind of information that an Air Force court, the Court of Criminal Appeals, should be allowed to look at. And in judging credibility, and that's provided that we're presuming that he, that this is information that was taken into consideration by the first court.
But you're saying evidence that was not admitted to the members.
Well,
I understand you're not conceding that it wasn't admitted, but your argument right now is assuming that there is matter between the blue covers that was not admitted to the members. The Court of Criminal Appeals can consider that matter for purposes of factual sufficiency or for purposes only of credibility within the concept of factual sufficiency.
Let me say this, that I gave the background information about how our reading of 66C is that it seems to be all-inclusive. But in light of reading the cases, the subsequent case law, that it seems to limit the matters, and I'll go with Holt and Bethea, that A, were subject to cross-examination, and B, that the evidentiary nature wasn't changed. That seems to be Holt. Holt is, you're not changing the evidentiary nature and putting that and using that for something different. And that the information also under Bethea was subject to cross-examination. I think that those two factors are exactly what we have here. It's the pretrial motions, A, that they were subject to cross-examination, and B, all that information was ultimately admitted at court anyway. So really, there's not a change in the evidentiary nature. And I think it's that between 66C, Bethea, and Holt, this court can certainly say when their first court, when a court of criminal appeals is looking at a decision, if it was subject to those factors, that you can judge certainly credibility in light of the fact that the Air Force Corps has to be convinced themselves for the factual sufficiency review and judge credibility.
So is it the government's position that if the Air Force Corps looked at matters that are that were not admitted to the members and decided that a key witness was not credible and found the evidence to be factually insufficient, thereby dismissing the charges, that would be proper? That is, it's within the prerogative of the Air Force Court to look outside the matters that were admitted to the members on the issue of factual and legal sufficiency. Not about all the other matters that might be at issue between the blue covers, but strictly on the issue of the facts. That the Air Force could look at that matter outside the record and determine that the charges should be dismissed, even though the evidence was never admitted into trial?
No, the government's not suggesting that. That if the evidence was never admitted at trial, then that presents a problem, because then you're changing the evidentiary nature rule, like in Holt, if you, you know, evidence is admitted for a limited purpose, or saying I'm basing, I think it is that evidence that simply wasn't admitted, the court looked at, so, like another Article 42,
right. So for,
it was never admitted.
Right, so that for purposes of determining, both from the perspective of the government and from the perspective of the defense, then is it the government's position that the Court of Criminal Appeals is confined on the issue of factual sufficiency to the matters that were actually introduced before the members, and that the court cannot, and I understand you're arguing here that they did not, but the court cannot look to, let's say, the testimony in the Article 32 for purposes of assessing the credibility of a witness in a manner that would lead the court to find the witness to be not credible and therefore dismiss the charges against the government.
Well, I guess I would say that's what the case law suggests. That's what Thompson in particular suggests.
Is the government urging us to change that case law at this point?
The government is asking that perhaps the court should extend and make a Beatty rule, for example, that allows the courts of criminal appeals to judge credibility based on evidence that was presented at trial and that also was subject to cross-examination. I think that's a fair interpretation of Holt, Bethea, and Article 66 together.
And I guess just to be clear, when you talk about evidence presented at trial, and I guess maybe this is where my confusion is coming, are you talking about that they can look, as long as the evidence has been presented at trial, that they can look at 32 hearing testimony and motion hearing testimony to see if it's consistent with the evidence presented at trial, the testimony adduced at trial, or are you talking about something different?
No, I'm saying that the evidence had to be presented at trial, and that evidence, whatever pretrial motions, for example, or Article 32 testimony, which was the subject that was admitted, was also given scrutiny via the cross-examination, that for credibility purposes, the Air Force Court should be allowed to go through and say, these are, for example, consistent statements, for purposes of credibility, since that's being attacked here by the appellant, we believe in our factual sufficiency review, we are too convinced.
What about if they were inconsistent? I'm sorry.
That was the same question.
Well,
is this a heads, I win, tails, you lose game?
No, because the problem comes in is that at court, for example, it's not often that you have prior consistent statement at court unless the defense has attacked for example, in this case, the victim, and that there's a recent fabrication. So that's just very rare to come in, but it's certainly consistent information. Not really considering any additional information. Certainly, credibility is always at issue, whether it's at the pretrial motion or subsequently at court. So I think that it really simply goes to, it's hard to prove a negative person if she's consistent at trial, how else are we going to win her case?
Counsel, it seems to me that the government is at far greater risk here than the defense, because the evidence has come in and the individual's been convicted, and there are very, very few cases where the Court of Criminal Appeals has ever said we don't find the evidence to be credible and make a determination on that basis. They do it on occasion, but not very often, because they're aware of their statutory mandate to take into account that the members heard it. But if we were now to say that Court of Criminal Appeals, it's okay for you to assess credibility of evidence that was admitted, that by looking outside the record at, for example, the Article 32, then the government not only has to defend the admission and use of that testimony at trial, but runs the risk that the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to look at testimony which may have been presented by different counsel for far different purposes at a 32, in which the motives for cross-examination are very different at that point. And the Court of Criminal Appeals is going to say, well, based on this 32, we don't find this witness to be very credible, and the charge is dismissed. So I'm not clear on, and of course the interests of justice are what one would expect government counsel to represent, as opposed to simply the government winning or losing. But in that context, I'm not sure why the government would want this court to say affirmatively, well, Court of Criminal Appeals, go to it. Go look at those 32s and see whether that witness really was credible.
Well, perhaps extension to the 32, depending on the case, you're correct. It's the evidentiary nature of the facts that came out in the 32, that is, they were doing a cross-examination, whether it's trial counsel or defense counsel, who's based on a different landscape or different issues. You don't have the same.
Yeah, even if it's the same. First of all, that would lead us into lots of litigation as to whether there is the motive to cross-examine, which is a tough thicket to be into. But let's assume it's the same motive. Why would the government want to say to the Court of Criminal Appeals, by the way, you've got a license now to rule against the government by assessing the credibility of witnesses based upon what they testified at the Article 32?
Well, I think bottom line is the error in favor of the
you know, appellant is not always a bad thing, but for the interest of justice, the Air Force Court is charged with determining on their own de novo review of the factual sufficiency. And I think that in many cases, as long as the evidentiary nature is not changed, that the Court of Appeals is not going to run into a situation that's any more different than what happens now. Typically, the testimony is going to be consistent. Perhaps the Courts of Criminal Appeals give more deference to what occurred at findings and just simply slap on top and, oh, here, by the way, this is what verifies our factual sufficiency review, is that she was consistent here, or maybe she wasn't consistent, but at findings we find it her testimony to be convincing. I think that the Courts of Criminal Appeals can obviously do that and not run afoul this litigation that Your Honor suggests.
Counsel, can you, after hearing all this discussion, can you give us a succinct statement as to what you would like us to say? And it seems to me that you want us to say that a CCA, for purposes of assessing credibility, can consider evidence not heard by the members when? In every occasion? And is there any limit on that? I mean, what are your guidelines there?
I guess I disagree with that statement. We're suggesting that with evidence that was heard by the members and subject to cross-examination also, for example, in this case where you have on the pretrial motion, you have...
But they were considering her testimony at the Article 32. And the members did not hear that testimony. They also said they were considering the testimony on sentencing. Prior to their findings, they hadn't heard that. So, I mean, there may have been consistent testimony given during the hearing, but here we're talking about comparisons. That's what's important. There is evidence and testimony that wasn't heard by the members that, in your brief even, you say that they relied upon, that it bolstered their determination, that it corroborated their determination. So, clearly, I think we're in agreement that they used it. You're trying to convince us that that's permissible, and what I'm trying to do is trying to define exactly what the scope of that should be.
Let me first say that our argument first stands on the proposition, and I'm not sure that I clearly wrote this in my brief. First, the proposition is they didn't rely on this information. It's background information as is evidenced by the petition and subsequently the order. So that's first.
Well, then, having said that, how do you explain in your brief at page 3 where you say that this testimony bolstered their determination regarding credibility, and page 10 where you said that the evidence corroborated the lower court's findings?
Well, that's going towards, again, the three prongs of my argument. The first one, and then the second one was this should be information that should be allowed, which that addresses, and
okay.
There's no prejudice.
Okay, I'm sure.
I think that this argument I'm making here really just came to me very recently, and so...
Recently as in the past 30 minutes?
past day. So
you're not arguing that the Court of Criminal Appeals can look outside the admissible evidence to supply facts that it would otherwise determine to be missing, necessary to sustain a conviction, that you're asking for a bolstering provision for looking outside the admissible evidence. It doesn't add to the facts that were there, and it's somehow different from their de novo review.
If I'm understanding, yes, Your Honor. It's kind of like the credibility rule, that since credibility is always at issue at every stage, that once you find the factual sufficiency, and that's what happened here, they found the factual sufficiency based on the findings in the findings portion of the case, but then just simply, just simply saying, by the way, here's why this supports our contention based on the other findings.
Can you relate that argument then to the plain text of Article 66?
I think that the plain text of 66, which
because we're on the topic of credibility, and here it says we have, on the one hand, the entire record. On the other hand, we have judged the credibility of witnesses and determined controverted questions of fact, recognizing that the trial court saw and heard the witnesses. So does the trial court see and hear the Article 32 witnesses? Is an Article 32 before the trial court, for example?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. So please relate your position to the actual text of, presumably, the law we're supposed to be applying here.
Sure, Your Honor. This last bit here, I think, is suggesting the standard in which the Court of Criminal Appeals should look at generally at the findings. And so, but I don't think that necessarily apply. I don't think that necessarily you just read that. Okay, we're looking at the witnesses, and you generally determine in the findings, okay, we are too convinced that he's guilty beyond reasonable doubt. And that our view, though, is that taking into consideration, we didn't see them ourselves. But I don't think that necessarily precludes that based on that standard, we find that the facts are sufficient. But then, oh, by the way, considering we didn't see her testify pretrial motions, we still believe that story is consistent and therefore still credible, piled up on top.
So that section, in your view, is subordinate to the previous section. Look at the whole record. Oh, by the way, keep this in mind as well. Is that how you're reading it?
Yes, sir. We're reading it as look at the entire record and then, oh, here's kind of the standard that you want to look at.
So do you read it as suggesting that due deference be given to the fact that they didn't actually see the witnesses at trial? I mean, is that what that last clause means, or do you think it means something else?
I think it means when looking at what occurred findings, give some deference to the fact that you didn't see the witnesses and they did.
Is it your position that what the CCA did here was not ambiguous?
That is correct.
Okay. That in fact they simply used this for elaboration, and that is clear from their opinion.
It is clear based on their opinion and the motion, the petition for retrial order in which he.
So we should read opinions, for example, when you're reading a Supreme Court opinion, what you do is you go back and see which petition was reviewed by which justice and see how they voted on it, and in that way we can determine what they meant in their opinion?
Well, no.
Is that the standard legal practice?
No, but I think when you're looking at the standard in Mason, looking at this, is we suppose that the Court of Criminal Appeals does their job, they know the law, they apply it correctly. And in the absence of something else, clear and convincing, which I think Judge Erdman wrote in Mason, if there's something clear and convincing that suggests otherwise, then you should look at it. And I think that it's not clear and convincing that they didn't do a proper review here. And that, then, based on looking at any ambiguities, I think it's important to go to the record and see exactly what happened. And part of that is the petition for new trial written by the justice. You can get inside his mind almost and see what was going on between the two. So I think that's important to decide any ambiguities. If there are questions concerning that point, I would like to briefly address the prejudice here. And the bottom line is the information that was provided to the members was no different at any other time. And I don't think appellant has failed to show here that the Air Force Court would have come to any other reasoning other than it did. I mean, it was pretty clear. While there was some credibility determinations, there was still in the record of trial, there was some corroboration of her testimony, so forth and so on. I think that this information
is so small with regard to, oh, we found four times she testified, four times and it was fairly consistent. I don't think there's enough here to suggest the ethics court could come to any other conclusion than what they did.
I mean, if we thought that an improper review took place, is there any precedence that says that we can apply a harmless, that we can basically say that there's no prejudice, or don't we have to send it back?
No, I think in Roderick and Goins, if I'm not mistaken, and I think in Goins, Judge Erdman wrote a concurring opinion talked about, well, even though there was an error here, there was no prejudice. And I think Roderick also, my fingertips are cold if I could. Maybe she has to go.
We'll take it. We'll give you some extra time.
And I appreciate it. I mean, it's an honest question. I honestly don't know the answer. That's why I'm asking you.
Roderick at 62 MJ 425, which was, again, Judge Erdman, talk about on on page 431, at the bottom of the page, because there is harmless in light of the other evidence that photos portray the city's exhibition of the generals. So there is case law present to suggest that.
That was on legal sufficiency. You take Jenkins, for example. Are you familiar with the Jenkins case?
I'm not. I apologize, Your Honor.
That's a case where the issue was to what extent the lower court was, just using my words carefully, the lower court was reproducing portions of the government briefs verbatim in their opinions without attribution. And this court didn't ask the question, would the result have been the same? This court concluded that the person hadn't gotten the 66C review they were entitled to. The question was not, would the result have been the same, test for harmlessness. The question was, did they get what they were entitled to, which was a fair 66C review. Now, you've put up your triad, but if we get past the first two prongs of your triad and you're in prejudice, isn't the issue whether they got the 66C review that they were entitled to, not whether the CCA would have come out the same way?
Well, again, I haven't read Jenkins. I guess I disagree in light of the language in Roderick, but this error is harmless in light of the other evidence that the photos portray. It suggests that there's other evidence that does the job without regard to whether the Air Force Court looked at the wrong evidence or not. And so I guess I would disagree that is necessarily the standard. But provided, looking at the standard in Jenkins,
and you're not, there's no trick here because you haven't had a chance to read Jenkins, so.
Right. Well, I think
it's
so.
Not enough.
But I think looking at your statement, I think that.
My question.
You have the same. You can come to the same conclusion under either standard. I mean, here, I think it's fair to the 66 review. It's fair to say they looked at the findings, they came to that conclusion, and that. I'm out of time.
Please conclude.
That considering the nature of the evidence that there were, and again, not conceding that it was outside the record, but considering the nature of the evidence that they suggest the four times that she testified under oath and seems to be consistent, I don't think that impacts the overall fairness of the review itself. The whole record was looked at, all the issues were fleshed out, and in the end, I think their opinion focused on the findings that were presented, and this is just a byline. So if I may conclude,
yes,
Your Honor, the government thinks that
the language in the opinion was not relied on. There's no clear and convincing evidence to suggest they relied on that information. Even if they did, the government is suggesting that that's the kind of information that should be allowed by the courts of criminal appeals to judge credibility. And in the end, there was no prejudice. There were no questions?
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have a rebuttal?
Your Honor, very briefly, I just wanted to point out a couple of things. Judge Ryan, you had asked a question about whether or not that, where that particular quotation came from, and I just reproved the record. It is from the trial on the merits on page 197. Yes, ma'am. I almost feel like we're sort of arguing, as the captain was arguing, that anything, you know, Judge, I think it was the Chief Judge asked, you know, is this really a standard that the government wants to set? And I'm not sure that the same doesn't apply to the defense, but there are a couple of things that I wanted to point out to the court. The last thing that the government was discussing was the question of prejudice. And if you read Washington and Jenkins, and I think, as I recall correctly, Judge Baker, you may correct me, that after Jenkins came out, there were a number of summary opinions issued by the court, quoting Jenkins and saying the same thing, which said that they had not been given a fair Article 66 review. That's all we're asking for in this case. And Judge Stuckey, you asked me that question earlier. We're asking for a fair Article 66.
But in terms of harmless error or prejudice, if there we're in a situation with multiple citations for bolstering, confirming credibility that were presented to the member, and there was one citation from outside, is it the defense position that this court cannot consider prejudice in that context?
You know, I think, Your Honor, based on the Washington decision, as you know, and sometimes it leads to an absurd result, and possibly that would be one of them. But you know, I think based on the Washington decision, as Judge Duke was saying earlier, you know, if it's not clear, then the court does have to remand, and you know, perhaps it would lead to an absurd result where in a 20-page opinion there was one reference to something outside the record. And, you know,
no, that's not my question. In Washington, rightly or wrongly, the court concluded that the opinion of the lower court was unclear, and therefore it had to be remanded. My question is, suppose it's perfectly clear that the court below properly cited a lengthy list of bolstering items and improperly cited one for bolstering on a tangential aspect of it. And I know you're not conceding that here. We're not asking you to concede that here. But I don't know whether my question is, why does Washington control that? Washington is a case in which there is a determination that there was ambiguity. Here, if we were to conclude that there is no ambiguity, that they improperly, and I'm not suggesting we will, but if we did, that there is no ambiguity, that they improperly relied on two matters, are we absolutely precluded from saying it is nonetheless harmless because of the manner in which it was considered?
I think you've asked me two separate questions, Judge, and let me sort of try and answer them. In this case, well, I guess let me answer your question.
No, I understand. I understand your argument. In this case, that's not it. You're arguing both that, at a minimum, that it's ambiguous, and if it's not ambiguous, they improperly relied on two other matters, and it's not harmful. There's no way you can find harm.
You answered the first one.
That's not my question. I understand your argument. My question is, are we precluded, not by the facts of this case, but as a matter of law, from even considering whether, assuming that it was error for them to cite these matters, and assuming it was outside the record, are we precluded from considering harmlessness? In what case would preclude us from considering harmlessness?
I have to be candid with the court and say probably not. You know, if you had a case in which there was, you know, like I said, 20 pages worth of factual and legal sufficiency review by an appellate court, and then they threw in one line, and, you know, they considered, I don't know why it just came to my mind, but a check that was not considered, you know, then I think that a harmless error analysis may apply. I think this is clearly not the case.
That was my sole question. Thank
yes, Your Honor.
And why is this clearly not that case?
Well, I think it's clearly not that case for a couple of different reasons, Your Honor. One, I went back and redid my math, and it's not one out of three paragraphs is a third, but probably in terms of the total number of sentences, it may be something closer to 20 or 25%. But I don't think that there is any way for this court to be assured that the Court of Criminal Appeals conducted a proper legal and factual sufficiency simply because of the amount of reliance that they placed on matters outside of the record. And I think that the power that the manual gives the Court of Criminal Appeals, if that power is going to mean anything, it means that in a case such as this, where it is so unclear, and I would actually argue that it's not unclear that they applied an improper standard. I think it's clear that they did apply the improper standard. But even if one were to give them the benefit of the doubt and say, you know, it's at best ambiguous, then that requires a remand for a new Article 66 review in order to give him, as Jenkins and Washington State, that fair and impartial Article 66 review that the manual requires. Thank you, members of the court.
Thank you for your appearance today, and we thank both counsel for the parties for their presentation of this case. The case is now submitted, and the court will be adjourned. That completes our arguments for the week.
Thank you, Your Honor.